we didn't print out in our last handout verses 36 through the end of chapter 11, so that's the first page, and it goes over on to the back. And then I had started printing, I put the first five verses of chapter 12 on the back of that one, but then I started over again on this second page with some notes along the side, and it runs down to the end of the chapter, and then I put the last details thing on the back. So what I wanted to do this evening is to remind you again that Daniel clearly, without any dispute, arranged his material in the first part of the book in a thematic order so that it was not strictly chronological. He would give us chronological connectors, but they were out of order. First year, third year, last night, etc. And from the chiastic structure of chapters 2 through 7, we could see very clearly that he was dealing with major theme. And I think James is the one that encapsulated the major theme in the book of Daniel with his statement, God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. I think you can summarize the book of Daniel under that thesis, even though that's not a prophetic. As we pointed out last time at the end of chapter 11, 135 prophecies in chapter 11 already fulfilled. So obviously prophecy is the big deal, but the message of the prophecy is the bigger deal. And the message is always going to be the issue of our relationship with God. It's never going to be the infatuation with future events and all that kind of stuff. Even though the details are important and we don't want to minimize what God has told us is going to happen. But having said that, I believe that chapter 11 is best understood. In fact, I don't think you can understand verses 36 to 45 if you do not remember that Daniel is dealing with themes. And two of the big themes in chapters 2 through 7 was his fixation on these little horns. I was going to use the word fascinated, but he was awed by the blasphemous mouth of this little horn in the fourth empire. And he was extremely curious as to what was going to happen in the face of that towering blasphemy. And of course, God told him what was going to happen. He's going to be cast in the fiery stream. But then there was another little horn in the third kingdom, and they overlap in terms of characteristic attributes and that kind of thing. So at the end of chapter 8, Daniel was confused. He didn't understand, and there wasn't anybody to explain it. And you have to keep in mind, too, that there were long periods of silence in between these visions. You have one in the first year, and then you have one in the 11th year, and then you have, you know, there are great big huge time gaps. So Daniel obviously had made records of what he had seen and all that, so that he could pull it all together at the end. So he was well advanced in age when he ended up writing this book. And that's probably why he felt like the message needed to be, well, James said it this way, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Because God resists the proud, gives grace to the humble. And we all know that grace is one of those undemandable characteristics. Grace is not grace if you can leverage it. You can compel somebody to be gracious to you. They haven't been gracious to you. Operating under compulsion is not grace. However, the scriptures do hold this out for us in the book of James, that if we will humble ourselves, God will give us grace. So in that sense, you can at least appeal for grace by deliberately humbling ourselves. That's the commitment that God has made. But I said what I said about the themes because I believe that at the beginning of chapter 11, verse 36, we actually have a linguistic problem in the text if we don't recognize his dealings with these two horns. Because the first part of chapter 11, once he gets past the Medo-Persian time and he goes into the Greek Empire and then he begins to deal with the king of the south and the king of the north, and that's the Seleucid dynasty and the Ptolemies, which are the offshoots of the generals of Alexander the Great. That's going on constantly through chapter 11. The north, the king of the north attacks the king of the south. The king of the south attacks the king of the north. Na, 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 na. And all the way up to verse 35, which is during the period of Antiochus Epiphanes. But in verse 36, it says the king will do according to his will, and he'll exalt himself against the God of gods, and so on. And then it says in verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him. So the him of verse 36 is not the king of the south or the king of the north, and it's deliberately focused on at the time of the end. So he has jumped thousands of years from Antiochus Epiphanes, the little horn of the third empire, to the little horn of the fourth empire, who is the presage to the coming of Messiah as the stone cut out of the mountain without him, hands which will fill the whole earth and the saints will inherit the kingdom. So he's jumped from the little horn of the third kingdom in verse 35 to the little horn of the fourth kingdom, and he didn't know it at the time that there would be at least 2,000 years in between that. He didn't know. God didn't tell him that, and it wasn't necessary for him to know it. But if you remember that he's writing thematically, then you can understand his jumping, because he's dealing with the theme of the abomination of desolation. The first abomination of desolation was Antiochus Epiphanes slaughtering this pig on the altar. The second abomination of desolation will be the Antichrist setting himself up on a throne inside the temple of God and proclaiming himself as God. So, given that reality, I think that it's completely impossible to understand verses 36 to 45 if you don't recognize that, because the language shifts and then it leaves you just kind of spinning on your, you know, if you don't realize that he's jumped from horn to horn. Now, at the end of that, it said in verse 44 that tidings out of the east and out of the north would trouble him, and he would go forth with great fury, and he would plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas, that's the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean, in the glorious holy mountain. That's God's kingdom in Israel. Yet he will come to his end and none will help him. And of course, the coming to his end with no help is the picture that Revelation 19 presents very graphically, when Jesus comes back and he slays the armies of the world, and he takes the beast and the false prophet and casts them alive into the lake of fire. He came to his end and nobody could help him. So, this evening, when we start in chapter 12, verse 1, it says, now at that time. So it's at the time when the king, the willful king, has, according to Daniel 9, he will cause the sacrifice to cease in the midst of the 70th week. So you have this 1260 day or 42 month time, or this time times and half a time thing. And then before that, it was governed by a covenant that he made of peace with the many. But then he breaks that covenant and sets himself up in the temple in Israel, in Jerusalem. And that just completely throws the whole peace covenant with Israel kaput. So Israel has to flee to the mountains and all that kind of thing. But that's the stage setting for the statement in verse 1, at that time shall Michael stand up. I'm glad myself that we're going to be able to watch this. This is going to be fantastic when Michael stands up. That's a figure of speech. It's not like he's been sitting down all this time, because we were already told by the messenger in chapter 10 that he had been waylaid by the princes of Persia, and they had kept him from being able to show up and give Daniel this information for 21 days. I don't understand angelic warfare. I mean, I can understand in general terms, but in specifics, what weapons do angels use? And since you can't kill them, how do you, what do you, I mean, you know. I just don't know about all this stuff, but they've got to have some kind of way of hindering one another and messing with each other's plans and all that kind of stuff. In fact, personally, I believe that Luke's account of the birth of Jesus, when the angels came to the shepherds, the language of the text is that this host that showed up, these angels, The word that's used by Luke is a word that indicates a martial order. And so you have this huge host of angelic beings in martial array that show up. The shepherds can hear them sing and see them. Nobody else can. But the question is, what are they doing there? And the answer is in Revelation 12 or 13. Because in one of those two chapters of Revelation, the imagery of the woman who gives birth to the king, the Messiah, has this dragon waiting on the birthing so that he can destroy the child. Well, on the earth, that was Herod and his desire to kill him. Nobody knew there was this angelic warfare in the background that was causing a bunch of this stuff. But on the planet, the human part of that was Herod killing all the innocent babies that were 2 years old and under that were male in Bethlehem. But I believe that those angelic hosts were the hosts of the armies of God, and they were there because Jesus was going to be born and needed to be protected and all that kind of stuff. So again, I just don't know. I don't know what kind of weapons they had. I don't know how any of that kind of stuff works when you're dealing with spirits that don't have bodies. Angels are not hindered by physical body limitations, whatever. David said, shall I go out against them? Yeah, I'll go. I'll give them into your hand. Next day, they come back. Shall I go out against them? No, go around behind them. And when you hear the rustling in the trees, that's when you attack, because that's when the armies of heaven are going to be getting into it too. So, it's deadly for humans to get involved in an angelic conflict. But when Michael stands up, this standing up is to oppose the now devil-possessed son of perdition, is the New Testament term, the Antichrist, this king, willful king. So, it says of Michael that he is the great prince which stands for the children of your people. And there is indication in other places that Michael took Lucifer's place as the archangel. He was top authority among the angels. In fact, it says that in Revelation 12:7, there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels waged war. So Michael's the head of the angelic host. So when he stands up, it's Katie bar the door. And keep this in mind. Since there is no propagation of angels, the number static. It's an innumerable host. 10,000 times 10,000 plus a few more millions and whatever. But nonetheless, 2/3 of those angels did not rebel when Lucifer did. So it's 2 against 1 when Michael stands up in terms of the angelic issues. But it says that he stands for the children of your people, Daniel's people, Israel, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that same time. Now, when you stop and think about that, this is the worst time in human history. And you can think back over the flood, for example. There's just a whole lot of bad things that happened over human history. Sennacherib, I think, lost over 900,000 soldiers in one night. That's pretty bad. But it says here there'll be a time of trouble that has never been since there was a nation until this time. And at that time, your people will be delivered, everyone who shall be found written in the book. Now, that's a statement that Paul picked up on in Romans when he said, having explained the times and how they've changed, all Israel shall be saved, he says, finally. Now, he doesn't mean all of the offspring of Israel, but he does mean all of God's Israel that is alive on the earth during the time of the Antichrist's dominion and sway. All of those will be saved. And that's what he says here. At that time, your people will be delivered. Well, he says everyone that shall be found written in the book. Now, the book of life and the Lamb's book of life is a little bit complicated topic, but it's not all that I mean, I didn't even know when I was in Bible college, my Revelation teacher assigned us an assignment to investigate and study out the Book of Life, the Lamb's Book of Life. And to me, they're the same book, but there is a difference. Because when the disciples came back after they'd been sent out on their first journey preaching, they came back and they were just hot. They're walking, you know, rejoicing because even the demons were obedient to their commands. And Jesus said, don't rejoice over that. Rejoice that your name's written in heaven. Well, that's a good thing to rejoice over until you get to Revelation 3, where he tells the messenger of the church of Sardis, I believe, that if he doesn't straighten up, he's going to blot his name out of the book of life. And so you get this blotting out business. And then you have Moses, when God says, God, I'm away, I'm going to kill them all and start over with you. And Moses says, no. So he stands in the breach between God and the people, and he argues with God about what will happen if he does that. And then he says, if you will forgive their sins, well, but if not, blot my name out of the book that you have written in their place. And that's the same kind of thing that Paul was saying in Romans 9 when he said, I'd be willing to perish eternally for the sake of my kinsmen according to the flesh if it would do any good. I mean, he didn't say that, but that's what he meant. He would be willing to be the atonement. God told Moses, nah, I'm going to blot those out of the book who have sinned against me. And no. Well, you get into a pickle with this book of life and all that, except for Revelation 13:8 and Revelation 17:8. Because there, the distinction in the book of life is written. It says that there are some people whose name is written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. But it is the book of the living, so everybody's name is written in as soon as they become alive. But those whose names are written from the foundation of the world can't be blotted out, but the ones who are living and alive and their name's in there, if they don't trust Christ before they die, their names are blotted out. And that's why at the Great White Throne judgment, at the end of the Revelation, you have the judgment of the Great White Throne, which is only for unbelievers. It's a judgment to find out where in hell they're going. And I say that deliberately because the judgment seat of Christ is an issue of where do believers get plugged into the kingdom based on the way they walk with God or not in this world. The testing of their behavior, flesh with fire, gold, silver, and precious stones remain, all the rest is burned up. The outcome of that evaluation is, okay, this is where you serve me in my kingdom based on what's left here. Put you in your place. There's abundant evidence in the New Testament in Jesus' own teaching that hell has different degrees of difficulty for the people that are there. And the more violent, atrocious you were, the deeper in hell you go in terms of temperature and consequences and all that. So, the judgment of the Great White Throne, where everybody's judged according to their deeds, that judgment is not to decide whether they go to heaven or hell or not. It's to decide where in hell they're going to go based on their deeds. So, if you're an unbeliever, it's best if you die early. Jesus said, to whom much is given, much is required. But in relation to the book of life, then, what we have is this. We have this group whose names are written in the book from the foundation of the world. And then we have all the rest whose names are written in the book as soon as they qualify, because it's the book of the living. If you are alive, your name's in the book. If you die without repentance, without faith in Christ, then he blots your name out. That's the caution in Revelation. This guy, he says, I know you have a reputation that you're alive, but you're dead. And he didn't talk about physical. He's talking about spiritually dead. The guy's the pastor of the church, and he's spiritually dead. He says, if you don't repent, you're going to have your name blotted out of the book. So, the point is that all Israel shall be saved, which is Paul's terminology. Daniel says, everyone found written in the book will be delivered. And all that means is, the book of Daniel is a book of prophecy which tells us one thing real clearly. God's got a plan and he's pursuing it, and these are the details, and they're going to happen exactly the way I told you they're going to happen. I, you know, resist it if you want, but that's the facts. That's the way it'll be. So, then in verse 2, it says, "And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake." And then it has some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. Now that needs to be understood, because in Hebrew, the master pronoun is these and those. It's not some to everlasting life, it's these to everlasting life and those to shame and everlasting contempt. And he's talking there about these that are, names are in the book of life that are to be delivered, that have slept in the dust of the earth. They've already died. They will wake. This is the resurrection. These to everlasting life. And then you have somebody who's going to say, well, what about the rest? Well, those will be resurrected to shame and everlasting contempt. And we, in on the basis of verse 2, we would jump to the conclusion that this is general resurrection. Everybody's resurrected, and these are resurrected to life, and these are to shame. But when you get to the book of the Revelation, it says the resurrection of the just happens 1,000 years before the resurrection of the unjust. So here again, the implication of verse 2 that this is a simultaneous double resurrection event is not true. It's not the implication of the words. It's just, that's what we jump to. But then further revelation, in the book of Revelation, it says, the first resurrection is the resurrection of the just. Then there is another resurrection 1,000 years later, which will result in the great white throne judgment. So you got to keep that in mind too. Huh? Yeah, that cast in the lake of fire after the judgment. So he's talking in verse 1 about Michael standing up to deliver the people, and then he talks about a resurrection that's going to occur. Now we're assuming that that means it's going to occur after he's delivered the people. In other words, the 70th week is over, and then there's this resurrection of Israel. And since all of the rest of the dead that were believers were resurrected 7 years before, if you're pre-trib, in your rapture, everybody was either resurrected or transformed, so there were no believers left to be resurrected until people during the tribulation period started believing the gospel and having their heads cut off. Then you had another resurrection that was necessary for them to participate. So that resurrection is apparently what he's talking about in verse 2. And then he says in verse 3 that those who are wise will shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn to righteousness, many, shall be as the stars forever and ever. And here he's simply talking about people who decide that they're going to live according to what the Word of God says. Those are the wise. And the people that are not wise, they're the ones who say, I don't care what the Bible says, I'm going to live my life my way. Well, there's a consequence of that. In fact, I think, based on all the stuff I'm hearing on TV and all the stuff that's going on in the United States, that you could almost write Psalm 2 over the United States. Psalm 2 says, why are the nations raised? And why do they imagine a vain thing? They say, come, let's throw off his constraints and let's just do our stuff. And it says, he that sits in the heavens will laugh. Well, you're seeing what the laughter means and all the consequences that are coming. But, Daniel, shut up the words. Seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. And the implication of that knowledge shall be increased is the gradual appreciation of what these revelation of these mysteries will grow in clarity, so that at the time of the end, people will be able to better understand all of the stuff that Daniel's written down. And that's true, because 500 years after Daniel wrote this, John wrote the book of Revelation, and he gave us a whole lot more details. So, the knowledge will be increased. It doesn't deny the general concept that knowledge will be increased, because I think the internet has sparked the possibility of you knowing just about anything you want to know. If you know how to search the internet, you can find out just about anything you will find out, if you're skilled enough at it. And then Daniel says, I looked, and behold, there stood two others, one on this side of the bank of the river, and the other on that side of the bank, and this goes back to chapter 10. I wrote on the side, it's almost like the Mount of Transfiguration, two others getting into the conversation. You remember? Because when Jesus was transfigured, Moses and Elijah got there, and they were conversing with Jesus, and Peter, you know, did his thing. And the one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, and remember that man clothed in linen is probably the image that Daniel described when he just wiped him out. He just collapsed. How long will it be to the end of these wonders? And the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him that lives forever and ever, it will be for a time, times, and half. Now, we've already run into that time, times, and half, but we're also given some specific indications of the meaning of that in verse 11. From the time the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Well, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the 1,260 days is exactly 42 months, which is exactly 3.5 years, which time times and half the time is 1 year, two plus 2 years plus a half a year. So right here in Daniel 12, we have the time times and half a time tied to the 1,290 days. And then he talks about the 1,335. But just to be clear on the time, times, and half a time, he has been asked, when will the end of these wonders be? And the wonders have to do with the willful king of chapter 11, verses 36 to 45. And when Michael stands up to bring this 70th week to its culmination, how long will it take? And he says, time, times, and half a time. 42 months, 1,260 days. That's how long it's going to be. But he says, I heard, but I didn't understand. And I said, oh, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, go your way, Daniel. The words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified. Oh, and by the way, there's a lot of, with that statement, many shall be purified, there's a lot of consternation among the philosophers and even Christians and non-Christians in these days about why does God allow so much evil in the world? And there are multiple biblical answers that have this to say about it. It's a time of purification of the saints so that they can be clothed in white, they can be tried, they can be purged. The wicked will do wickedly, and the wicked won't understand, but the wise will understand. So, the proper answer to why does God allow wickedness in the world is to develop the saints for the kingdom. That's the reason He allows it. But, we have Romans 8:28 underlying that whole thing. God has guaranteed for those that love Him and are called according to His purpose that everything will work together for their good. Whether it's a bad thing, a good thing, and it... you know, a nothing thing. Everything works together for our good if we are believers. So there is not a single solitary evil thing that ever happens to us that God doesn't bend that thing to our advantage, forces it to serve our best interests. And that's the whole point. His purpose is to bring us to eternal life. And life is a qualitative experience of joy unspeakable and full of glory. So we think we know what a good drink of water tastes like, but you drink that first sip out of the river of the water of life and you'll realize you never knew what water tastes like. But anyway, it's going to taste like something you've never tasted before. But he does give us this verse 11. From the time that the daily sacrifice will be taken away. Remember in chapter 9, the 70th week, the man that was going to, the people of the prince that shall come, the prince that shall come was going to make a covenant with the many. And then in the midst of the week, he would break that covenant. Well, this is that. The time where the daily sacrifice is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up. From the beginning of the 70th week, we have two periods. The 70th week is seven 360-day years, divided evenly into 12 30-day months per year, so that 1,260 days is exactly, 42 months is exactly 3.5 years. So you have two 1,260-day periods. And from the time the abomination that makes desolate is set up, and that I explained last time is where the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2 sits his throne in the temple of God. That is the final abomination, where the creature tries to take on the identity as the God. Lucifer tried it first, and we've been trying it ever since. And the final abomination will be when this man of sin proclaims himself as God, sitting on the throne in the temple of God. When that happens, he says, there'll be 1,290 days. Well, now that raises a question. It's 30 days over the 1,260. So, what's going on? And then he says, blessed is he that waits and comes to 1,305 days. So that's 1,335 days. So we have 1,290 days from the abomination to something, and then we have 1,335 days from the abomination to the blessedness. Blessed is he that waits. So the question is, what are these time factors connected to? And the only answers that we have is if you measure the activity of the man of sin, the one who sets up the abomination, from time times and half a time is from the abomination to chapter 11, verse 45, where you have the news coming out from the north and the east, and the Antichrist sets up the tabernacles of his palace in Jerusalem, or in that area between the two seas. So that's 1,260 days. But the issue is the ruler's end, and the 1,290 days is from the abomination to chapter 12, verse 2, in my understanding, and that's the resurrection of the righteous. So there's going to be a 30-day period from the time that Christ comes back and he casts the desolator into the desolation. The desolator will be made desolate. When he casts the willful king into his final state in the lake of fire, that's at the 1,260-day end. And then it's going to be 30 days, apparently, until the next event. And the next event introduced in the text is the resurrection. So there's going to be a 30-day lag, and then there's going to be this resurrection of the just. Those who are asleep in the dust of the ground shall arise to everlasting life. And then you have this 1,335 days, which is another 45 days. And the question is, well, what does that refer to? Well, the statement is, blessed is he that waits. So the implication is that the pinnacle of blessing is 1,335 days after the abomination that makes desolate. And the question is, what is that? And I think that the answer to that question is found both in Daniel 2 and 7, where the stone cut out of the mountain becomes the kingdom. Messiah is coronated. His coronation is on the 1,335th day, and he is made the Lord's Christ over the kingdom. Blessed is the person who gets to witness that coronation, because that's the introduction to Messiah's eternal kingdom. And we don't know from this that there's going to be another period of time involved where there's going to be some significant difficulties, because we don't have the book of Revelation at this point. But the book of the Revelation tells us that Christ is going to have 1,000-year reign. It says seven times in about 6 verses in Revelation 20 that it's 1,000 years. And at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan, who has been restrained in the bottomless pit, is released for a short period, and he stirs up the armies of the nations of the world, and they surround Jerusalem in rebellion, and fire falls from heaven, and poof, there they go. All of the unbelievers of the entire...
And they lost again.
1,000 years of of human beings being born and raised in Messiah's righteous kingdom. And they're still rebellious at the end. And the rebellion is caused by only one thing. Right now, we have the world, the flesh, and the devil. Well, then, the world is going to be under the dominion of the Christ. The devil is going to be in the bottomless pit. That leaves the flesh. That's us. So, when human beings that are born during this thousand-year period of time, they're going to be experiencing the kingdom of the righteous kingdom of Messiah. They're going to be surrounded by the truth. But in their hearts, there's going to be rebellion smoldering. And their unbelief will cause the rebellion to smolder even more. And the instant judgment on the wicked is going to make them even angrier. So all it takes is for Satan to be released for a little while, and he'll stir up all that hidden heart rebellion until there is a massive gathering of every person who's lived under a thousand years of Christ's reign and retain their unbelief in the face of all of the evidence. Those rebels will surround Jerusalem, and then God will destroy them. Fire from heaven will just destroy the whole thing. And then we have a new heavens and new earth created. But that's Revelation. I really believe, of course, I'm a dispensationalist, so I order my thinking according to what God's doing in history. But I really believe that the thousand-year reign of Christ is designed to prove one thing. And that is that sin in the heart of a created personality is so profound a difficulty that it alone, without any other encouragement, will cause a deep-seated hatred and rebellion against God. It's designed to prove that once and for all. Because we do, but it's going to be in terms of degree. It's like in the Old Testament, the point of the law was to prove to man that he couldn't live up to the standards of perfection that God required under law. He wouldn't make it if he tried to appeal to God on the basis of his performance. Do it or die. That's the message of the law. Well, they had 1,500 years, and they didn't learn that. When John the Baptist came on the scene starting to preach the doctrine of grace, they hated him. When Jesus preached the doctrine of grace, they murdered him. When Paul preached the doctrine of grace, they had Rome destroy him. They hate it. And there isn't any explanation except that this is what sin does.